Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller. We're going to start off today with a recipe from smittenkitchen.com for one of my favorite things, super simple dish, but it's just so good, Spätzle. A couple of months ago, we went out with friends to a new Austrian restaurant in our neighborhood, and over too much Gruyere and very large dark beers, got in an animated discussion about Spätzle and how it was the perfect food. It manages to be both dumplings and noodles at once, and is good tangled with cheese and herbs and bacon and vegetables as it is alongside a hearty braise. It is never unwelcome. And then my friend turned to me, I guess I'm presuming I'm a person who knows how to, like, make things, and asked me how it was made. And I realized I had no idea. This never happens. Not that I'm clueless, as I am routinely clueless, especially in the realm of denim, but it's rare that I haven't a single inkling as to how a food is made. But homemade Spätzle, I hadn't even considered it before. Of course, I forgot all about this conversation for a while. See above, Gruyere and very large dark beers. Until last week, when I found 5 whole minutes to flip through the Balthazar cookbook in peace and spied a recipe for Spätzle. Hey, did you know that Spätzle is ridiculously easy to make? That it uses only 3 ingredients that I'm willing to bet you already have at home, and it cooks in 2 minutes? What I'm saying is, you could have Spätzle for dinner tonight, and I think you should. Still, I made it as complicated as possible, but all so you won't have to. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. First, I made 2 different batters. The one from Balthazar uses more eggs than a more standard one I kept seeing, so I decided to make both and do a side-by-side comparison. Then I tried several techniques of dropping the batter into a pot of salted boiling water. The first, the one that Simplicity had called to me from the Balthazar book, involved spreading a small amount of batter near the edge of a cutting board and using a knife or offset spatula to push small ribbons of batter into the pot. And look, I'm not saying the whole knife board thing doesn't work. I was informed that it was favored by Austrian housewives after all. It simply didn't work for me, as I ended up with a lot of large, flabby pieces, and I wanted daintier ones. A thicker batter might have worked better. Next, I tried the colander method, pushing the batter through the holes of a colander into the cooking water, but quickly found pressing thick colander of batter over a boiling pot of water was very unpleasant and hot and awkward. And after that, I tried to use a makeshift pastry bag, i.e. a sandwich bag with a corner nipped off, but I found the Spätzle too tubular and no more enjoyable to form over a pot of hot water. Not giving up easily, I turned to a potato ricer, certain I'd found my Spätzle-making nirvana, but it dumped 1 hamburger-sized Spätzle blob in the pot and was quickly relieved of its Spätzle-ing duties. At this point, my kitchen toddler and I were gummed top to bottom in Spätzle batter, and I escaped to my laptop to consider whether, despite my general anti-single-purpose appliance stance, if a Spätzle maker might be a good thing to have around. I actually whimpered with frustration when I realized that one that people seemed nuts about was less than $10 and proceeded to call a few kitchen stores to see if they sold it, but none were in stock. So it was back to the colander for me. But really, it wasn't so terrible. Once I switched to a colander with more than 12 holes that could sit over the pot of water and put on some potholders, I got the swing of things quickly. We found the eggier batter to make far more light and delicate dumplings, so I'm giving that one the green light below. Finally, there are 1 million ways to enjoy Spätzle, and I would like to discover each of them, you know, between sets of crunches. But we enjoyed the heck out of browning it in a pan with butter and tossing it with minced shallots and herbs. I'll get to that in a second. Simplest homemade Spätzle. Recipe from the Balthazar cookbook. Technique from trial and error. You'll need 2 cups of all-purpose flour, 7 large eggs, and 1/4 cup milk. Combine the flour, eggs, and milk in a large bowl. Cover with plastic wrap and refrigerate for 1 hour or overnight. Prepare an ice bath and bring a large pot of well-salted water to boil. If you've got a spatula maker, use it. Otherwise, do not fret. Set a large colander with holes anywhere from 1/4 to 1/2 inch wide over the pot. Put on 2 pot holders because you probably already know that steam is hot. I apparently did not. Pour 1/4 of the batter into the colander and press it through the holes with a flexible spatula. Boil for 2 to 3 minutes and then use a slotted spoon to fish the spätzle out and drop it in the ice bath. Continue with the remaining batter in 3 batches. I found it was important to use only a little batter at a time and even less if your pot is smaller, because if you push too much batter in at any time, it becomes one freakish mega spätzle as opposed to hundreds of tiny twisty ones. And when you're done with the batter, drain the spätzle well and toss it with a small amount of olive oil to keep it from sticking. You can use it right away or keep it in the fridge for a day until needed. Just here's a note, this other spätzle recipe I auditioned did not call for the resting time, and it worked just fine. I didn't test this version without resting it in the fridge first for 1 hour, but suspect that you could get away with it if you were pinched for time. That said, the batter was really lovely, smoother, stretchier after 1 hour, so if you can use that hour to prepare a salad or other parts of your meal, you should. So here's the recipe for pan-browned spätzle with shallots and herbs. You're going to heat a large skillet over medium-high. Heat 1 tablespoon of unsalted butter. Once it is fully melted and beginning to turn golden, add 2 cups of drained, cooled spätzle and let it heat for 1 minute in the pan before starting to sauté it about. Season with salt and freshly ground black pepper and continue to cook it until each piece has 2 of toasty brown edges. Add 1 tablespoon of minced shallot and cook for 1 minute more. Adjust the seasonings to taste and, off the heat, toss with 1 tablespoon of minced herbs. I used parsley and dill, but others like tarragon or chives would work well. Eat immediately. Our next recipe is for bean and vegetable burritos. While I haven't been strictly vegetarian in a long time, I still hold petty grudges. Grudges that I work out here in the form of the dishes that I've preferred as options over the mediocrity, the afterthoughtness of most meatless entrees, like gloopy pastas or vegetables cobbled together from sides from other dishes, sandwiches, cheese, and sometimes soggy lettuce or tomato, and burritos with so much filler. A recent trip to a Tex-Mex chain left me surprised as not much had changed. And as I chewed down my football-sized wrap that was 80% rice, 15% beans, 5% salsa, and cheese, my old resentment had come back in full force. Vegetarian entrees, sandwiches, and tacos can be so much more. And let's start here. This is my core recipe for a perfect every-time vegetable burrito, one that's filling, hearty, and exactly the way that I like it. This means that there's no rice in it, but you can, of course, add it. You can swap the spinach for another green. You can add vegetables you love and remove those that you don't. It's totally flexible. But even more essential, you can freeze these for another day. For years, I defrosted and rewarmed burritos in the oven. It took often 45 minutes or more for them to be hot again, at which point it seemed like I could have just made it fresh. Not sure why it took me so long to realize you could warm a frozen burrito in the microwave for 3 to 5 minutes, or realize that there's even a market for frozen burritos, but my life has had 3 times the burritos and thus joy since. Here's the recipe for bean and vegetable burritos. Servings, it makes 8 burritos, and time, 45 minutes, plus reheating time. Source, right here at the Smitten Kitchen. You'll need 2 tablespoons of olive or vegetable oil, 1 medium onion diced small, 2 large cloves of garlic minced, 1 fresh jalapeno or habanero pepper minced, 1 bell pepper diced, 1 teaspoon of ground cumin, 2 to 3 teaspoons of ground chili powder to taste, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1 14-ounce can of diced tomatoes, kosher salt, 2 15.5-ounce cans of black red or pinto beans, drained and rinsed, 1.5 cups of corn kernels, fresh from 2 ears, or canned and drained, or frozen, and no need to thaw. 5 ounces of baby spinach, roughly chopped, 1 lime, halved, 1 cup of crumbled cotija cheese, 8 ounces, about 2 cups of coarsely grated Monterey Jack or pepper jack cheese, and 8 large burrito-sized flour tortillas, and hot sauce to taste. You're going to make the filling by heating your largest skillet or sauté pan over medium-high heat. Once it's hot, add the oil, and once the oil is hot, add the onion, garlic, jalapeno, and bell pepper, and cook until the ingredients begin to soften, 3 to 4 minutes. Add the cumin, smaller amount of chili powder, and tomato paste, and cook for 1 minute. Add diced tomatoes and let simmer for 1 minute, then add the beans and simmer for 2 to 3 minutes. Taste the mixture and add salt. I find that I need between 2 to 3 teaspoons of kosher salt to get the level right, but adjust it to your taste. Add the last 1 teaspoon of chili powder if needed for your desired heat level. Add the corn and spinach and stir until the spinach has wilted and everything is warm. Taste for seasoning again and adjust as needed. Remove from the heat and squeeze the juice of half the lime over the mixture, then the second half if you like more. Let cool slightly while you get ready to assemble your burritos. When you assemble your burritos, if your tortillas are unbendy from the package, you can warm them briefly in a dry skillet or for 15 seconds in the microwave to soften them. If they seem dry, I might spritz them lightly with water before warming. Arrange your first tortilla on the counter and spoon about 3/4 cups of the filling in the lower third closest to you, and then sprinkle with 1/4 cup of jack cheese and 2 tablespoons cotija. If you like to make some burritos spicier than others, you can shake hot sauce on at this point. Fold the bottom of the tortilla over the filling, fold in the sides, and roll it up, setting it to cool seam side down. Repeat with the remaining tortillas, filling, and cheese. To eat right away, go for it, but I love to brown it in a pan on both sides for some added texture and to ensure that the cheese gets melty. Heat a skillet with a thin layer of olive oil over medium heat or any oil that you prefer, and add burritos and you're ready to eat. Cook until browned and crisp on both sides and dig in. To freeze for later, you can wrap the burritos individually in foil, that's best for oven reheating, or plastic and pack in a freezer bag with all the air pressed out. Burritos keep in the freezer for a few months or for as long as your freezer allows them to without imparting a freezery taste. To reheat from frozen in an oven, heat the oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Heat the foil-wrapped burrito for 40 to 50 minutes. To check for warmth, stick a toothpick or skewer into the center of a burrito and keep it there for 10 seconds. If the toothpick is warm and when it's ready to be removed, the burrito is too hot. If not, give it more time. To reheat them from frozen in a microwave, just unwrap the burrito and microwave on a plate for 3 to 5 minutes, turning over once midway. To check for warmth, stick a toothpick or skewer into the center of the burrito and keep it there for 10 seconds. If the toothpick is warm when it's removed, the burrito is too. If not, give it more time. For both methods, for that extra crisp once warmed, follow the skillet instructions under the to eat right away. As far as notes, chili powders tend to range a lot in heat level, so give it a taste before you start to make sure you're not surprised after adding the first 2 teaspoons. Depending on the size of my tortillas, I sometimes end up with 1 to 1.5 cups of extra filling, and you can use it to make more burritos or just heat it up with extra cheese and put an egg on top, and that's what I did with delight last week. Next, we're going to have a recipe for, I'm deciding between, let's go with the raspberry coconut macaroons. That sounds really good. Every year around this time, behind the scenes, I go through my annual macaroon marathon, in which I decimate bags and bags of coconut in an effort to find a variation on the lowly macaroon worth noting publicly, as evidenced by the fact that my archives are virtually coconut macaroon free. I hadn't thus far succeeded, but it wasn't for lack of trying. 2 years ago, insistent on making something my coconut-loathing but chocolate-adoring husband would find palatable, I made multiple attempts at chocolate coconut macaroons, and they were brown and tangly and rarely chocolatey enough. I don't remember them fondly. Last year's experiment centered on whatever appallingly bad home economics had led me to have 3 bags of unsweetened coconut in my pantry, and my determination that they would leave my kitchen in cookie format. They were okay. I'm sure more skilled macaroon makers than I make excellent macaroons from unsweetened coconut, but I found them consistently more dry and scratchy than those that began with sweetened coconut. This week's coconut macaroon trials were the most obsessive yet, with versions rolled in unsweetened coconut chips. Gorgeous, but man, are those chips unpleasant to chew. Chopped almonds, which are tasty but hardly noteworthy, and thumb-printed with the intention of filling the indentation with jam or chocolate down the road, but I lost interest before I did, so that's a sure sign that they were a snooze. And even flattened with designs on a sandwich cookie. Were it not for the one in which I had pressed a whole raspberry inside a sealed ball of coconut macaroon, I wouldn't be here discussing macaroons today, because although it was fussy and odd to construct, the flavor smacked unmistakably of cookie destiny. Coconut and raspberries were meant to be together. And here they are. The simplest steps raise these coconut macaroons from the ordinary to something we admitted macaroon ambivalence can't stop snacking on. First, I like to grind my coconut in the food processor, reducing the cough-inducing shreds to a thick paste that bakes into a delicately textured cookie. The sugar is kept in check, using less than half of what I saw in some recipes. Surely the combination of sweetened coconut and 1.5 cups of sugar is in the running for the 11th plague. The sweetness that remains plays off the tartness of fresh raspberries, which are not quite pureed, but left in little berry blips here and there in a sea of snowy cookie. Almond extract and sea salt fill in the missing pieces, and they scooped into little mounds that miraculously stay intact in the oven. I held my breath. Once cooled, they really are perfect on their own, tart and sweet, tangled together. But I would be unworthy of this microphone if you had granted me, were I not to tell you how much tastier they are with a drizzle of melted chocolate over the top. But don't worry, I did not drizzle chocolate over a few out of a greater sense of duty. I did it for the boss. Here's the recipe, raspberry coconut macaroons. I like traditional coconut macaroons, but I find it difficult to keep their sweetness in check, as there's no butter or flour to absorb the sugar. Tart, fresh raspberries, unevenly blended with the batter, make for a dreamy pairing. Pureeing the coconut, a technique I learned from Cook's Illustrated, makes these macaroons feel light and scratch-free, and you won't even believe how good they are drizzled with melted bittersweet chocolate. I did a couple, but stashed the rest in the freezer until Passover. I'll do the rest once they're defrosted. The result is my favorite coconut macaroon ever, one that will hopefully put to rest my macaroon marathons, at least for another year. If you'd like to use unsweetened coconut instead, keep in mind that it's very hard to guess how much sugar is in sweetened coconut, but I might start by doubling the sugar or possibly going up to 1.5 cups, which I've seen recommended on almond macaroon recipes that start with freshly ground and thus unsweetened almonds. Theoretically, the 14-ounce bag of sweetened coconut holds 5 1/3 cups of coconut, or so the Baker's brand bag advertises, but mine clocked in at less than 4 cups. I suspect that fluffing or compressing of the ingredient makes the cup volume vary greatly. This makes 50-ish 1 1/4-inch cookies. You need 14 ounces of sweetened flaked coconut, 2/3 cup of granulated sugar, 3 large egg whites, heaped 1/4 teaspoon of flaked sea salt, or level 1/4 teaspoon of table salt, 1/2 teaspoon of almond extract, 1/2 pint of fresh raspberries, if washed, patted very dry. Preheat your oven to 325 degrees Fahrenheit and line 2 large baking sheets with parchment paper. In a food processor, blend the coconut for a minute, add sugar, blend another minute, add egg whites, salt, and almond extract, and blend for another minute. Add raspberries and pulse the machine on and off in short bursts until they are largely but not fully broken down. I counted 13 pulses. I might have been a little obsessive, what with the counting. Some visible flecks of raspberry here and there are great. When you open the machine, you'll see some parts of the batter that are still fully white while others are fully pink. Resist stirring them together. With a tablespoon measure or a cookie scoop, I used a number 70 cookie scoop, you're going to scoop your batter into 1-inch mounds. You can arrange the cookies fairly close together as they don't spread, just puff a bit. Scooping a little of the pink batter and a little of the white batter together makes them look extra marbly and pretty. Bake the cookies for 25 to 30 minutes until they look a little toasted on top. Let them rest on the tray for 10 minutes after baking, or you can let them fully cool in place if you're not in a rush to use the tray again. This will be hard to move right out of the oven, and they'll firm up as they cool, but still remain softer and less dry inside than traditional macaroons. Thank goodness. Our last recipe is for crispy rice and egg bowl with ginger scallion vinaigrette. Serves four, takes 10 minutes, and the source is Spittin' Kitchen. I make this with cucumbers and carrots because it's what I have around most often, but I think this could be good with many vegetables, even leftovers, so go ahead and clean out your fridge before it gets terrible. If you have extra time, I like to toss the carrots with 2 tablespoons each of rice vinegar and water, 1/2 teaspoon of sugar, 1/2 teaspoon of fine sea salt to coat the strands. They begin to marinate and gently pickle while you do everything else, but the dressing is sufficient to flavor them if you're in more of a rush. While this is best with leftover rice, cold from the fridge, I made some fresh and cooled it to almost room temperature, and it was, in fact, almost perfect, and it crisps faster. I really like the starchiness of short grain white and brown rice here. I did not test this with long grain rice, but have crisped longer grain rice and other recipes with success. This recipe presumes 3/4 cup cooked rice per person. Adjust it to your preferred serving size if this is not it. This recipe has many things in common with dolsat bibimbap, which is served in a sizzling stone bowl that crisps the rice and is often with a raw egg, which cooks in the hot rice, or meat, and fresh and pickled vegetables. Although this is in no way intended as what it would be, a very lazy imitation. But if you love the flavors of bibimbap, you will definitely like what's happening in this fridge-scavenged hybrid recipe. You'll need 1 1/4 cups of minced scallions, both green and white parts, from a 4-ounce bundle, 2 tablespoons of minced or finely grated fresh ginger, a neutral oil, such as grapeseed, safflower, or sunflower, 1/4 cup sherry or rice wine vinegar, fine sea salt, about 1 cup of heaped julienne or coarsely grated carrots, 8 ounces of small Persian style, about 2 cucumbers, thinly sliced, 3 cups of cooked cooled rice, my favorite here is short grain brown or white, 4 eggs, soy sauce or tamari to serve, toasted sesame oil to serve, sriracha, gochujang, or another hot sauce of your choice to serve. To make the vinaigrette, you're going to mix your scallions, ginger, 1/4 cup of oil, and sherry or rice wine of vinegar in the bowl. Season with salt. I use about 1/2 teaspoon of fine sea salt. Set aside. To crisp your rice, you're going to heat a large frying pan over medium-high. Add 1 to 2 tablespoons of oil. You'll want to coat the bottom with a thin layer of oil all over. Nonstick pan, as I used, are more forgiving here, so you can use the lower amount. Heat the oil until it's hot, another minute, and then scatter half of the rice over the surface. It's okay if small clusters remain. Season lightly with salt and do not touch it, and in 3 to 5 minutes, the underside will become golden brown and crisp. Use a spatula to flip it in sections, then fry on the other side until it's also crisp. Divide between 2 bowls and repeat with remaining rice, dividing it between 2 remaining bowls. Crisp your egg. If there isn't enough oil left in the pan and you want a thin layer, add another splash and heat this on high heat. Add eggs one at a time and season lightly with salt and pepper. Cook until brown, lacy, and crisp underneath, and the whites are opaque, bubbly, and dramatic, and the edges are brown. You can spoon some oil over the pan or from the pan over the egg whites to help them cook faster. Place one egg on each bowl of rice. Assemble the bowls. You're going to arrange some cucumbers and carrots in each bowl, and then spoon 2 tablespoons of vinaigrette onto each of the bowls. Drizzle each egg with a half teaspoon of tamari and toasted sesame oil, letting it roll into the other ingredients, plus hot sauce to taste. Eat immediately and repeat frequently. As far as doing ahead, the dressing will keep for 5 to 6 days in the fridge, and the chopped vegetables will keep for 3 to 4. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.